asked as he piled smoked sturgeon onto a slice of bread. You weren't sleeping. Perhaps I was. Not unless you sleep in a starched shirt, cravat, and waistcoat. I could see your clothes full well from the street. Damn you and your observations.
Pasha laughed. Then the jest fell away, and he leaned into the table. The flickering candlelight in the tavern cast harsh shadows across his face.
Things are happening, Nikolai.
Nikolai set down his bread and leaned away from the table, pressing himself against the booth's wall.
What things? The refacing of Nevsky Prospect, the Nivar Fountain, the Canal of Colors.
Was that what the city's residents were calling their moves? Nikolai's scar flared at the reminder of the game.
Don't tell me you haven't noticed it, Asha said. Have you even left your room in the past week? Or are you keeping something from me?
Nikolai poked at his bread.
Yes, and no. I mean to say, yes, I have left my room and even the house. And no, I'm not keeping anything from you.
Pasha scrutinized him. Nikolai charmed his own face so that Pasha wouldn't be able to see the falsehood on him.
All right, Pasha said. If you have indeed left the Zakrevsky prison, then you know what I'm talking about, yes? The preparations for your birthday. Yes, I've seen them. The mechanics are impressive. Chort!
Nikolai arched a brow. Pasha rarely cursed, especially not in Russian. Nikolai was also unconvinced that Pasha was saying it correctly. But what did they know? They spoke mainly French. Pasha was unapologetic for the profanity.
Mechanics! That's an utter lie, and you know it! This is enchantment, Nikolai. No one else recognizes it because they don't know it exists. Russia used to be full of magic, but then it faded away because people either started fearing it or stopped believing in it. For example, did you know that the forests and lakes used to be rife with fairies and nymphs? But they've died out from neglect and disbelief. And yet, he continued, you saw that girl in the forest on Ovchinen Island, whether you'll admit it or not. Tell me you believe me, that magic is real. Tell me I'm not losing my mind.
Nikolai poured another shot of vodka for himself, as he pondered whether to confirm or deny it. He had actually considered confiding in Pasha many times before, both about his magical abilities and the related indignities heaped upon him by Galina. But he had always stopped short of confessing. For one, Nikolai knew Pasha looked up to him, as backward as it might be for the Cesarevich to admire a nobody from the steppe. And Nikolai was loath to have yet another thing that set him apart, for he wished to fit in with his friends, not stand out. On the flip side of that, Nikolai might work for Pasha someday, and he wanted to enjoy their friendship as it was for as long as possible, before that dynamic in their relationship shifted. And third, Nikolai did not want to tell Pasha about his abilities when his magic was eventually going to be used to kill someone. Not that it wouldn't be revealed at some point, should Nikolai survive the game. But he didn't want to think about that. That was a problem for the future, if that future existed. Honesty, sometimes, was the worst policy. Nikolai poured vodka for Pasha, too, but his friend shook his head. So Nikolai raised his own glass and muttered, Mievo zdarovya, to my health, and knocked back the shot. He washed it down with more than a sip of beer.
Tell me I'm not losing my mind,
Pasha said again. Nikolai squeezed his eyes shut, then opened them. Pasha appeared to be tilting. Nikolai smacked himself on the cheek, and Pasha was righted. If anyone at the table was losing his mind, it was Nikolai. Especially now, since the alcohol had gone straight to his head. He hadn't eaten a thing since the afternoon.
Fine. Magic is real,
he said, before he could stop the declaration from trickling out.
Zut alors.
Why had he said that? What was this vodka made of? Pasha sat up. His smile returned.
I knew it! But how do you know?
Nikolai scrambled for a scrap of truth without revealing himself.
My mother was a faith healer. You had a mother?
Nikolai crossed his arms.
Has a single shot of vodka completely shattered your brain? Of course I had a mother. Everyone has a mother, at some point. My apologies. I didn't mean to offend. I simply meant, I didn't know you knew your mother. I don't. She died during childbirth.
Pasha looked down at the table, roundly chastened. Nikolai sighed. He hadn't intended to squelch his friend's enthusiasm, but alcohol made his words clumsy, like lumbering giants attempting to construct a glass dollhouse. There were bound to be accidents.
I don't know anything about my mother, only that she was a faith healer, and the people in my tribe believed her abilities to be real.
Pasha glanced up.
Are you a faith healer?
No.
At least Nikolai could say that without lying. A few tables away, a chair fell over. Or rather, it had been knocked over, as a man stood and thumped his fist on the tabletop.
We have rights,
he yelled.
The Tsar must know he cannot continue to treat the people like vermin. We need the revolution. Shut your trap, or we'll all be tossed into prison,
one of his companions shouted. Nikolai and Pasha watched as several men pinned down their friend, the mutineer.
Should we report him?
Nikolai asked Pasha. Pasha hesitated. He squinted to look at the man, and Nikolai wondered for a second if Pasha knew him. But then Pasha shook his head and sank back into the shadow of their booth.
He'll sleep it off and come to his senses. I don't want Nusultan in trouble for harboring traitors when he's only guilty of harboring fools.
Present company excluded, of course.
Of course, Pasha said. But listen, I have an idea, unrelated to that ruckus.
Another drink?
Nikolai reached for the vodka. Pasha waved him off.
I'm going to hold a ball for my birthday. Father will think I'm finally rising to the level of pomp expected of a Cesarevich. And Mother will be thrilled that I might find a wife.
And your real purpose?
I'm going to invite the Lightning Girl.
The bottle of vodka slipped from Nikolai's hand, and he lunged to catch it, and also charmed it at the same time, so it would not crash and spill all over the food on the cutting board. But as soon as he snatched the bottle, his eyes darted up to Pasha's. Had he seen? Nikolai should not have done that. In his tipsiness, instinct had taken over. Pasha looked at the bottle and Nikolai's hand for a few seconds. Then he shook his head and said,
"Nimble catch, Juliet."
Nikolai exhaled.
So,
Pasha said, as he fiddled with the cutting board.
I went back to Ovchinen Island the other day. I discovered the girl's name.
Nikolai thumped the bottle of vodka onto the table.
You went to the island to look for her?
Are you mad?
Perhaps Pasha was included in the fools whom Nusultan harbored.
Are you afraid of her?
Pasha asked.
More than you'll ever know, Nikolai thought.
not only because the Lightning Girl could very well kill him, but also because her canal of colors had stirred something in Nikolai he hadn't known was there. Of course, her waterways were a swaggering jibe at his work on Nevsky Prospect. And yet, there was also something deeper there, something more untamed. All these years, Nikolai had been alone, with only Galina's minor magic keeping company with his own. But now there was suddenly another enchanter in his life, and he felt a paradoxical kinship with her. It dissolved the edges of his loneliness, like finding the path home after years of wandering the wilderness on his own. And although it was arrogant how she'd changed the colors in the canals just to taunt him, Nikolai also admired that she wasn't afraid to do so. Which made the girl all the more dangerous. She was the enemy. Nikolai could not afford to be drawn in. He was also afraid that Pasha would fall for her, seeing as he had already gone far out of his way to track down her details on Ovchinen Island. How could Nikolai kill the girl if his best friend became infatuated with her? Aloud, Nikolai said,
"A rational person would be wary. A rational person would not go seeking to invite someone like that to a ball. Why invite her? To entertain your guests with feats of fire? You can hire the flame eaters from the circus for that."
Pasha picked at the label on the vodka bottle.
"Or perhaps I will ask her to dance.
Pavel Alexandrovich!"
"Don't call me that."
"Fine, then. Pasha."
"What?"
"You can't."
"Can't what?"
"Invite her. Dance with her. You're..."
Nikolai lowered his voice to a whisper.
"You're the Cesarevich of the Russian Empire."
"So?"
Pasha threw up his arms.
"Doesn't that mean I can do whatever I please?"
"You know it doesn't. Your mother has rules about whom you can even flirt with, let alone dance with."
"Guidelines."
"What?"
"Whom I can flirt with. They're guidelines, not rules."
"Pasha!"
The Cesarevich slumped in the booth. He jammed his hands in his hair, and it rumpled to such an extent, it finally looked as if he were a patron of low enough birth and means to frequent this tavern.
"Someone like me," Nikolai thought.
He too sank lower in the booth. After a bit more wrenching, Pasha finally released his abused locks and said,
"You know, I've been reading a great deal about mystics and enchanters. They're not evil, contrary to popular belief. They're misunderstood, and the church and the people's irrational fear of their powers have driven them underground to hide their magic. How dreadful is that? Imagine how taxing it must be to hide your true self every minute of your entire life."
Nikolai bit his lip.
"I want her to know it's all right," Pasha said.
"To what?"
"To live in the open, married to the heir to the throne."
Pasha scowled.
"That is not what I meant."
He picked up the now warm shot of vodka Nikolai had poured for him earlier, muttered a toast to the Tsar's health, and gulped it down. His mouth puckered, but he didn't bother to chase the vodka with beer.
"She's not the type of girl you can send a glass slipper to and make into a princess," Nikolai said. "You never know. She could turn out to be the wicked fairy godmother instead." "Now you're conflating your fairy tales. The wicked fairy godmother is from the Sleeping Beauty in the Wood, not Cinderella. And why are you convinced the Lightning Girl is dangerous?"
"So many reasons."
Nikolai rubbed the back of his neck.
"We know nothing about her. Her name is Vika."
Nikolai's scar burned at the same time that the knot in his chest. That foreboding sense of kismet that had begun when he saw the canal of colors tightened.
Though she be but little, she is fierce. Quoting Shakespeare won't sway me, Nikolai. Then what can I do to dissuade you from searching for the girl again, or inviting her to the ball?
Pasha topped off their glasses.
You can't.
Then he lifted his glass and toasted.
To the lightning girl, and all else that may come.
Chapter 22.
Why hasn't he killed her yet?
Galina's teeth chattered, even though she was inside the cabin while the Siberian blizzard raged outside.
Because I taught Vika well,
Sergei said. He cast a look at the fireplace, and the flames expanded, filling the small cabin with more heat.
Well, I also trained Nikolai well.
It's been only 5 days since the oath.
Galina turned up her nose.
He ought to have dispatched her by now.
Sergei recoiled, but he quickly composed himself, for to show Galina that her comment had ruffled him would only encourage her to mention Vika's death more than she already did. He had learned this lesson from their youth, when Galina had tortured him mercilessly with whatever made him most uncomfortable. Like murdering squirrels in the park with her glare, and laughing when they fell out of the trees, their eyes already glassy and unseeing, and then laughing harder as Sergei mourned them through a curtain of snotty tears.
We don't know what form the game has taken, Sergei said. You imagine an outright duel, but knowing Vika, I suspect it's something more subtle. She did not spend her entire life confined to a tiny island, only to have her magic, her freedom, constricted to a few short days in the game. She's going to savor the experience. Both you and your student would be gravely mistaken to take that as complacency or lack of skill.
Galina smirked and stalked over to the kitchen table. It had originally been constructed of coarse logs, but Galina had changed it into Italian marble.
You haven't grown too attached to the girl, I hope? Have you even told her you aren't her real father?
Sergei furrowed his brow.
What are you implying?
He'd thought everyone believed she was his daughter. He certainly thought his sister, whom he hadn't seen in decades, would think so. Galina conjured up a cup of steaming tea.
Honestly, Sergei, she looks nothing like you. And even though you did not care to check on me in St. Petersburg all those years, I did check on you. Actually, I paid someone to do it from time to time, because that sort of work is beneath me. And I know for a fact that you never married or had even a mistress. But it's fine if you want to pretend Vika is your daughter. It's sweet, even.
Galina's mouth puckered.
All right. Cloying is more accurate, but that's your choice. All I want to know is, where did you find her?
I didn't.
Sergei.
Fine.
He knew if he didn't answer, she'd keep pestering him. And seeing as they were trapped in this cabin together, it was far less painful to relent now than to continue taking her abuse.
Galina already knew the crux of the truth, anyway. I found Vika on the side of a volcano, on the Kamchatka Peninsula, when I was there on a research mission studying winter herbs. Her mother, a volcano nymph, had abandoned her.
Galina sat back in her chair.
I thought nymphs were extinct.
So did I.
Huh.
Galina contemplated the fact for a moment, then leaned forward again and said,
The girl really isn't your daughter, then?
How like his sister to be able to shrug off the existence of a magical creature in order to torment Sergei some more? He grumbled.
Blood determines nothing. Vika is my daughter, no matter what you say.
For someone as surly looking as you, you're disgustingly soft.
It's better than being surly on both the outside and the inside, like someone else in this room.
Sergei reached over and helped himself to Galina's tea, ignoring her scowl.
I suppose you've remained cold and distant from your student, haven't you? You are so very talented at alienating people.
Why would I form an attachment to a half-breed orphan from the steppe?
Galina scoffed.
I trained him because it was my duty to do so, and because I want to see my enchanter demolish yours. I like winning, you know.
Oh yes, Sergei knew. Although more accurately, Galina should have said she liked winning against him. It had always been about beating him, beginning when they were small children, and she wanted more of their father's attention. She'd never outgrown her insecurity at being born a girl, even though their parents hadn't played favorites between them.
It's a pity raising Nikolai didn't stir any maternal instinct in you. It would have been nice if Vika had grown up with a friend in the family to play with.
Galina plucked her teacup out of Sergei's hands.
Maternal instinct? Ha! You can't stir something that doesn't exist, thank goodness. And as for Vika having a friend, that is ridiculous, and you know it. They are enchanters, Sergei. They were always going to have to fight each other and die. They couldn't know who the other enchanter was, let alone be friends. Besides, you hate St. Petersburg, and would never have come to visit. I would never have visited you on that godforsaken island either, because I hate nature.
She glared again at sheets of freezing, tumbling white outside the window.
You honestly don't love Nikolai, then? After all those years, you can't say that even a single beat of your frigid heart belongs to the boy.
Galina smiled, and her teeth gleamed at the points, as if she filed and polished them to appear that way. Except Sergei knew she'd always looked like that. She had always been a wolf.
Every beat of my heart belongs to myself, mon frère. You'd do better if you kept yours to yourself as well. We did our jobs as mentors, and that's that. No need for us to hurt unnecessarily when one of them dies. But that's exactly what will happen if you insist on remaining attached to your student.
Sergei snorted, as if he could so easily discard every memory of Vika, from watching her go from crawling to walking to leaping through trees, from teaching her the alphabet to how to conjure a doll to how to summon rain from a barren sky, from telling her she could grow up to be Imperial Enchanter, to finally leading her to her fate at Bolshevnoi Duplo. No, it was impossible to extricate Vika's life from his. He wouldn't be who he was now without her. Sergei plucked a slice of slightly burnt onion bread from the plate on the table. Even this reminded him of Vika, not only because she would have brought him a perfect loaf from Ludmila's bakery, but also because she would have shared it with him. Bread, he said to Galina, a peace offering of sorts, or as close to peace as was possible for siblings in a cramped Siberian cottage. She waved it away.
You know I don't eat peasant fare. Besides, why you insist on baking bread yourself when you can simply conjure it, I will never understand.
He wagged a finger at her. Food is one thing magic does not do well. You know that.
That's why you hire a cook at home. Although I can't imagine you in the kitchen, even if it were possible to conjure decent meals.
I doubt magic could make bread much worse than what you bake.
Sergei shrugged, slathered butter on his burnt slice, and crammed the entire thing into his mouth.
I'm going to die of hypothermia before they finish the game,
Galina said.
It's only October, for heaven's sake. It's downright indecent for there to be a blizzard in the middle of October.
Sergei chuckled and opened a book on the medicinal herbs of Siberia. He didn't mind the snow. He rather liked it, actually, especially when it fell so heavily that one forgot it was composed of individual snowflakes rather than a single blanket of fleece. And he enjoyed how much the blizzard upended his sister.
A little precipitation never hurt anybody, he said. Settle in, dear city girl. It may be a very long winter.
Chapter 23 Aijana rose with the sunset at her back, casting a long, barbed shadow on the dry earth. It had taken her much longer than she'd anticipated to traverse the distance from her grave. But now, finally, she'd reached the cluster of yurts she'd seen shortly upon resurrection. The brown grass snapped and whimpered under her feet. She clomped her way to the fire pit, her left leg dragging a bit behind her right, but the left foot hadn't fully reanimated. The women who'd been tending the meat on the spit shrank back. Aijana recognized a handful of them, their faces the same, but for age-cursed wrinkles.
"Where is my child?"
she asked Demira, who in her 50s was the eldest of the women. Demira stared at her with unblinking eyes. Perhaps it wasn't how Aijana looked. Her face was skeletal, with yellow-gray skin stretched taut in places and sagging in others. Her hair was missing in patches, and what she did possess hung limp and dirty like decaying fishing nets. Or perhaps it was how Aijana smelled, as she had been dead for nearly 2 decades, and simply infusing a decaying body with new energy would not undo that unfortunate fact.
What are you?
Demira asked.
What do you want? I want my baby. I don't know who. You don't recognize me?
Aijana bared her yellowed teeth.
Someone run to the pastures to summon help,
Demira whispered to the other women.
I would not advise it.
Aijana raised a fingernail in the air. It was as long and sharp as a blade. The women remained obediently in place, or more accurately, they were too terrified to move. Aijana limped to the edge of their fire.
I am going to tell you a story,
she said as she settled herself on the ground. Demira, who was the closest, had enough sense not to wince at Aijana's stench. Aijana took in a long breath. The smell of roasting meat filled her with a distant memory, and she fell swiftly into her tale.
Once, many years ago, there was a girl with golden eyes who lived happily among her people. She was renowned not only for her fleet-footed dancing and fine embroidery, but also for her extraordinary touch. She was a faith healer, and she could redirect energy from one part of an ill or wounded person to another part, from a strong stomach to a weak spleen, or from powerful lungs to an arrow wound. Because of that, she was one of the most valuable girls in the tribe, and as befit her position, she was betrothed to their leader's son.
But then, when she was 16, a regiment of Russian soldiers arrived near her village. Curious, she and the other girls snuck out to spy on them. They intended only to have a peek. She did not expect one of the soldiers to spot her in the grasses. She did not expect to fall swiftly in love with his confidence and easy grace. She did not expect she would abandon her tribe to spend her nights in his bed, living hungrily on his love and his kisses. She certainly did not expect to wake one morning to find him and his entire regiment gone. The tribe took the girl back in, but she was disgraced, condemned to scrubbing laundry and hauling the manure of yaks. 8 lonely months crawled by. And on the 9-month anniversary of her first night in the soldier's bed, she gave birth to a baby boy, the umbilical cord wrapped like a noose around his neck. No! The girl uncoiled it and touched the bruise already formed on his fragile skin. Death stole into her yurt, reached out with its bony hands, and attempted to lift the boy away. But the girl snatched the baby back. "You cannot have him!" She hugged the child, the only thing she had, and heard his pulse fluttering like a dragonfly trying to escape. "Shh," she said. "Shh, I am a healer. I will save you." And then she thought of all the time she'd healed a wound or nursed an ache. It was simply a matter of moving energy, of shifting the patient's strength from one place in a body to another. She looked at the gasping baby in her arms. "What is stopping me from channeling my energy to him?" "Nothing. It would either work or it wouldn't." She focused on the place where the baby's skin touched hers. Then she felt her own energy flowing hot with the fear of losing him. She directed her remaining strength into his veins. The boy cried so loudly it shook the walls of her yurt. Death cocked its head and moved to take the girl, who lay weak on the dirt floor. "But I'm not dead," she whispered. Death paused, and then, instead of picking her up, it knelt and passed its skeletal fingers over her eyes to shut them. Because she was brave enough not only to face and defy death, and also to outsmart it, she was rewarded with sleep. In anti-death, the space between the living realm and the dead. But she would not stay in anti-death forever. She swore with her last breath that when she was strong enough, she would rise again.
The women around the fire pit quivered.
Do you remember me now?
Aijana smiled in a way that once would have been sweet, but now was nothing but rotting gums and disdain.
You rose from the dead,
Demira said, scrambling away. She did not go far, though, before she bumped into the other women.
No, were you not listening? I was never dead. I was merely not living. But I have returned, and I want my boy. Where is he? Is he out shepherding or hunting with the men?
He...
Is he out shepherding or hunting with the men?
Aijana asked again, the screech of her voice rising. Demira's eyes widened.
We haven't seen him in 11 years. He left the village.
Aijana scraped her fingernails against her papery temple. They rasped like claws against mottled snakeskin.
He could not have left on his own at age 7. What did you do?
Demira snivelled. The other women held one another, as if something so simple would protect them.
Where is he? What did you do?
Aijana snarled.
A Russian aristocrat came. She wanted him. You have to understand, he was too much for us. We didn't know what to do with his power.
You lived with me among you all those years. How could a boy be any different?
He was different,
Demira said.
You were a healer. You made people better. You were a force of good. He was like a demon.
Another woman, Tazagul, said. Her face glowed in the light of the fire.
He had too much power. It came from somewhere other than the people who needed to be healed. He wasn't like you.
My son is not a demon!
Aijana howled, and her shriek nearly drew blood from the women's ears. But if he wasn't a healer, then what was he? Could he be an enchanter? It would make sense, the way Demira and Tazagul described him. Healers utilized small magic, and the energy came from their patients. But enchanters could use greater magic.
Whatever he was, we did not know what to do with him,
Demira said.
And the Russian woman offered 2 horses and 2 sheep to take him away to train.
You sold my son for 4 animals.
No, we...
But that was all Demira got out, before Aijana pounced on her and slashed her throat with her wicked nails. Thick, hot red spurted everywhere. Aijana grinned. Then she siphoned off the energy as Demira's life left her body.
What have you done?
Tazagul said, trembling. She and the other women still kneeled on the ground, too paralyzed to flee. They gaped at their dead kinswoman.
Even if I was disgraced, my son was innocent, and you were supposed to mother him in my stead,
Aijana said, her voice now a low growl.
That is how a village works. But you left him without a mother, and now I will leave all your children without theirs.
She lunged at the women. She shredded them with her nails. 10 merciless blades compelled by vengeance. And as she killed them, she absorbed their energy, just as she'd done to the worms and the maggots in the ground. She was now so full of both life and death that it would take more than a mere bullet to kill her. And her left foot seemed almost awake, which was good, for apparently she had a long journey ahead.
Nikolai, she thought, I am coming for you.
Chapter 24. The following morning, Vika's apartment brimmed with the smells she had so missed. The sour tang of the Borodinsky bread starter in its pot in the kitchen corner, the sweet richness of farmer's cheese for the vatrushka pastry filling, and the brightness of fresh pears cooking down into jam. Ludmila had arrived last night at Vika's invitation. Vika had lived with her father her entire life, and being alone in an unfamiliar city, especially after the attack of the stone birds, felt too exposed, and the older woman had wasted no time taking over the flat's kitchen as her own, and laying out plans for opening a temporary Cinderella stall in St. Petersburg. When Vika walked into the kitchen, she found Ludmila with icing all over her face and apron, like a cake frosted by a flurry of euphoric 5-year-olds. Ludmila swayed around the tiny kitchen, her hips nearly touching from countertop to stove, humming a folk song. Vika sighed happily. How she loved folk songs. Her father sang them all the time. She sat down on one of the dining chairs. Its red lacquer was buried under a light dusting of flower snow. A Ludmila pastry storm.
You're a mess with the ingredients, Vika said. But you're a magician with the oven and stove.
Ludmila beamed as she flourished a wooden spoon in the air.
Thank you, my sunshine. But what I do is merely good chemistry. Butter and flour and water, combined with just the right amount of heat. The true magic is out there.
She pointed her spoon at the window, to Nevsky Prospect and beyond. Vika smiled.
Yes, the Tsar's city planners and engineers are quite talented. Oh, no. It isn't engineers who managed that river fountain. It's real magic. I know. And so do you and your father.
Ludmila winked. Vika's smile faded away.
Don't worry, dear. I haven't told a soul. I may be the island gossip, but I know when it's wise to keep my mouth shut. Not everyone would think so kindly of your abilities. It's the reason Sergei taught you to hide them. But how do you know? I grew up in a circus, my dear. You did?
Vika perked up in her chair. When she was younger, she'd longed to be part of a circus, moving from place to place and seeing the country. It seemed to be a place where the performers could be themselves in front of entire audiences, no matter how outlandish their talents might be. They had no need to hide in remote island forests.
Indeed, Ludmila said. And when you grow up in a circus, you learn early on how to distinguish what is real and what is made of smoke and mirrors. I'll tell you that most feats in the circus are pure trickery. But you and your father have something about you that cannot be hidden from those who know there is more to this world than what we see.
Incredible. Vika shook her head. She'd gone her entire life concealing who she and her father were, when right in front of her, every single day, someone else had known. She and father hadn't even bothered to cast shields around themselves when they weren't actively using magic, They'd assumed no one would be the wiser. Ludmila crossed the kitchen and wrapped Vika in her arms.
I know it's quite a lot to take in, dear. And I'm sorry I said nothing earlier. But I didn't think you or Sergei wanted your true natures known. Now, however... Well, you've decided to put your magic on display for all to see. And with Sergei absent, wherever it is he's gone, I thought you might need a mother. Or a friend.
Ludmila kissed the top of Vika's hair.
I am lucky to have you, sunshine.
But Vika only patted Ludmila on the back. Maternal affection was unfamiliar territory. After a minute, Ludmila released her, smiling from icing-covered ear to icing-covered ear. She hadn't seemed to notice that Vika had been hesitant to return her embrace.
The facades on the buildings outside are lovely,
Ludmila said. Vika laughed. She loved that her magic was being seen by others, but she couldn't take credit for something that wasn't hers.
It's true that I'm an enchantress, but the paint on Nevsky Prospect is not my doing.
Ludmila tapped her spoon against her chin, leaving sticky jam prints on her skin.
Really? There is yet another. What did you call yourself? Enchanter? How fascinating.
Vika nodded, and now she wanted to hug Ludmila. What a gift it was to have someone else know what Vika was, and what she could do. And then it occurred to her. She could tell Ludmila about the Crown's game. She would not have to bear it on her own. But no. One glance at the baker's jolly mood, and she dismissed the idea. Vika couldn't burden Ludmila with the knowledge that she was walking a tightrope to her death. And why spoil what she'd only now acquired? A confidant for her magic. No. She would not tell Ludmila about the game. Having her here, knowing that she knew what Vika could do, was enough. So instead, Vika stood and walked over to the counter. Ludmila had brought a glass pumpkin with her from the island, and Vika picked it up and turned the iridescent sculpture in her hands.
Well then, since you know what I can do, it makes setting up your new bakery a great deal more fun. How do you feel about selling pastries from another enormous pumpkin?
That afternoon, a team of men wheeled two large boxes, both a yard long on each side, into Palace Square. One of the boxes was plain red, with a large metal crank sticking out of its side. The other was royal purple, and decorated with scenes of ballet dancers on every face. There was no explanation given for the appearances of the boxes, nor did the crew that brought them know any more than the crowds that gathered around them. An albino rat scampered onto Vika's kitchen windowsill. She recognized him as the rat she'd fed a piece of blini to the other day, on her way back from the river. Vika circled her pinky over its head to translate its chattering.
Two boxes in front of the Winter Palace, Vika asked.
The rat's red eyes glowed brighter in confirmation.
I wonder what he's up to. You're mystery enchanter,
Ludmila said.
We should go right away.
Vika sat at the windowsill and fed a few scraps of leftover pastry to the rat, who tore at them greedily. The boxes could be a trap. Instead of cheese to snare a rat, it would be boxes that served as bait to catch an enchantress. Palace Square was immense, and her opponent could hide in the crowds. If Vika went, he could attack and kill her unseen. Ludmila wiped her hands on her apron and tossed it onto the counter.
What are you waiting for? This is why I came to the city, because it's more exciting than the routine at home.
Vika tried to smile, But if she died in Ludmila's arms, or worse, if Ludmila died in Vika's arms, it would not be exciting at all. Ludmila stood by the door of the kitchen, icing still smearing her cheek.
You know I'm going, with or without you, don't you? Well, if you put it like that.
There was no way Vika would let Ludmila around the other enchanter without her. Besides, Vika refused to be the type of girl who hid from danger, and she needed to see what her opponent's move was, so she could best him again. Because if he didn't kill her outright, the Tsar always could. Her death sentence was as simple as the Tsar declaring her opponent the victor. It didn't matter that she technically still had 4 turns. Vika walked over to wipe the smudges of frosting from Ludmila's face. Then she tossed the rat 1 more scrap of pastry before she grabbed her shawl and wrapped it around her shoulders, casting a shield around herself and Ludmila at the same time.
All right. Hurrah! An adventure!
Ludmila said as she launched herself through the apartment's front door. Yes, an adventure, but hopefully not a fatal one. Even though Vika had walked by the Winter Palace every evening since she'd arrived in St. Petersburg, its grandeur hadn't ceased to amaze her. It was a pale green and white Baroque masterpiece, its 3 stories lined with proud columns and arches, and almost 2,000 gilded windows. On one side of the palace was the Nivar River. She hoped the imperial family had a clear view of her fountain, her first gift to the Cesarevich for his birthday. And on the other, Palace Square, where the 2 peculiar boxes sat, and a crowd of several hundred now gathered. Ludmila fought her way to the front, using her girth and her elbows to clear a path for Vika to follow. A short fence of sorts had been erected, quite some distance from the boxes. But instead of wood, the fence was constructed of woven silver ribbon, each piece as wide as Vika's hand. There were no posts that supported it, and yet the ribbon remained cordoned in place, as if set through invisible stakes. Having made it to the ribbon, Vika scanned the square for obvious danger. Nothing, other than a larger-than-usual contingent of the Tsar's guard, likely owing to the sudden appearance of the boxes. And there, bobbing along the top of the palace roof, was the albino rat. He had very quick feet for a creature with such tiny legs. If he ever came back to her, she would give him a name. Perhaps Poslanik. Messenger. A figure moved in the window directly below Poslanik. No! Vika jumped in front of Ludmila and held both hands in defense in front of them. A transparent shield enveloped them, and the people behind them stepped away, as though they had been nudged, although there was no evidence they had been touched at all. But the figure in the window didn't attack. He didn't even seem to see Vika. He tilted his head, leaning it against the window pane, as if he too were waiting to see what the boxes would do.
Everything all right?
Ludmila asked. Vika nodded and stepped to the side, so that she was no longer in front of Ludmila. But she held on to their protective sphere, on top of the spell she'd cast before they left the flat, just in case. Behind them, the crowd grew to at least 1,000. Vika had worried that the other enchanter could hide in the masses and attack her. But he wouldn't try to kill her in front of all these people, would he? The Tsar had warned them at Bolshevnoi Duplo not to frighten anyone, and here they were, ordinary, non-magical folk, filling Palace Square to its very edges. It was not like Nevsky Prospect at dawn, empty but for the lone street sweeper. It wasn't even like her fountain in the Nivar, where it was easy to make it look as if her opponent had slipped. Here, there would be too many witnesses. In the distance, a bell tower chimed 6 o'clock, and the crank on the plain red box began to move, winding in slow circles to a tinny, playful scale. Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do. The music progressed from C major to the next scale, G major. Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do. And then the next, D major. And then the next, A major. The pace of each scale faster than the previous one, with the crank speeding up to match its pace. By the time the box reached the 12th scale, the crank turned at a frenetic pace. Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti. The top of the box exploded open on the final do, and out leaped a life-size jack-in-the-box. Vika and the rest of the crowd gasped and jumped back. But the jack, who was no longer in the box, and who had legs where his accordion body ought to be, stood still in front of his box, wavering slightly back and forth, as if he were still on his springs. Vika watched him carefully. There was something devious about his wooden grin. Beside him, a tinkling version of the music from the ballet Zephyr et Fleur began to play from the purple box. But unlike the red one, the lid of the purple box started to open as soon as the song began. As it lifted, a life-size ballerina doll, wearing a periwinkle blue dress and fairy wings, rose on a spinning platform, as if she were part of a music box. Now Vika had two dolls to track. As the song came to an end, so did the ballerina's twirling. It was then that the jack came back to life. He bowed to the ballerina, one toy to another, then danced to her box and offered her his hand.
"Don't take it," Vika whispered. "Don't trust him."
But the ballerina placed her delicate porcelain fingers in his wooden ones and pranced down to the cobblestones in the square. Vika shook her head. Ludmila pressed up to the ribbon fence, and because they shared an invisible bubble, Vika found herself pulled to the edge of the makeshift stage as well. The figure in the palace window likewise leaned forward as far as he could. Was it the Tsar, keeping track of the game, or the Cesarevich, watching the show put on for his birthday? A melody pealed out from the purple box again, this time for a pas de deux. The jack led the ballerina to the center of their cobblestone stage, where they bowed once again to each other. Then he set his hands gently about her waist, and she lifted onto the points of her shoe. Both arms arched overhead, and spun as ethereally as a fairy. They danced as the music played. The ballerina spun. The jack leaped. And when together, he lifted her, light as the doll that she was. Then the music began to soar, and their dancing did as well, with the ballerina and the jack whirling together so quickly they began to levitate into the sky.
"How are they doing that?"
someone behind Vika asked, as if he had forgotten they were not real people.
"There must be strings,"
another person said. But next to Vika, Ludmila said,
"They're like puppets, manipulated by masters they cannot see."
Too true. Vika knew the ballerina represented her, and the jack the other enchanter. Like the puppets, she and her opponent had never had a choice. Their destiny was a pas de deux, a splendor and a torment fated for the two of them. And yet, there was something about the other enchanter, about the magic he chose, that drew her to him, as if the bond between them was not an altogether evil thing. It was more like a tenuous thread attempting to reconnect two halves of a whole. And although Vika hated to admit it, she dreamed of him more than once. Each time he would appear as a shadow boy, but each morning, just before she woke, she would catch a glimpse of his real face. The bubble around Vika quivered.
"I am tied irretrievably to my enemy," she realized.
The jack and ballerina continued to twirl around the sky. The music soared louder and louder.